Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am back from my vacation. I want to thank Jason Hendricks and JP Nichols for holding the fort while I was otherwise engaged offshore. And in the studio with me today in New York is our good friend Penny Crosman from American Banker. Welcome, Penny.
Thank you. Welcome back to the States. Do you feel rested?
I do. I had fantastic time, actually.
You actually look rested.
That's good. That was a month away. I mean, I did some writing. I did a little bit of work while I was away. Ended up in China in Shenzhen with WeBank. Hopefully, I'm going to have an interview with the CIO of WeBank on a future show.
Awesome.
Good trip overall, but I did have some downtime. You know, it was my first vacation in I can't remember how long where I actually didn't have like something that I was worried about coming back to. Being an entrepreneur, you always have something. You can never just like take a break because there's always something. But this time it was like, no, things are in pretty good shape. You know, moving's well funded, the book's about to come out. You know, and of course, while I was away, the book launched, Bank 4.0. But
That's great.
Yeah. So it was good. It was a good break. But how about yourself? You had some time off?
I had 2 days in the Adirondacks, which was really lovely. Actually, in June, I went to Shenandoah National Park for a week, which is really lovely. I rented a cabin right on the river and did a lot of hiking in the national park. So
very cool. Well, let's get to some of the news, and then we have Michael Turpin who's going to tell us about his crypto case against AT&T based on a pretty significant theft of cryptocurrency.
Wait to hear about that.
That'll be really interesting. But in the news fronts, what's happening with Barclays debit cards? Apparently they're catching on fire.
That was one of the sort of more comical news items this week. Our friend Dave Birch tweeted out a picture of this letter he received that looked like it was from Barclays. It had Barclays' official letterhead at the top, and it said, many of our bank customers have reported that their debit cards have caught fire while they're in wallets and purses, and so as a precaution, we are issuing an urgent safety recall. This is a matter of the utmost urgency, as your credit card could create a pocket fire at any given moment, burning your legs and stomach terribly.
Wow.
This is because of a fault in the factory process at our debit card factory in Moulton Keynes. And then the address is to the address you're supposed to send the card to was to a Mr. Smith, Barclays debit card factory in Bangalore, India.
Bangalore.
Sorry.
That's crazy.
So I thought this was, at first I thought, our card's really setting on fire. It looked real. But obviously a bank would never actually recall cards that were setting on
fire. Yeah, they'd just say, cut them up and put them in the trash.
Somebody pointed out they should have done this right after the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 news came out with the catching fire on planes and so forth. So that was kind of interesting. I don't know how many people received that or fell for it, but kind
of
interesting.
A few, but they only need a few, don't they?
Right.
That's how these mass things work out. So
it's true. Very creative.
That's sort of the freak news. So before we get to the real news, because I thought that was funny, but before we get to the real news, a few conference announcements. September 24th to 27th is Finovate Fall right here in New York City. Breaking Banks is hosting the Power Hour session, JP Nichols, myself, and, of course, Breaking Banks regular Jim Marus will be on the main stage September 26th at 4 p.m., so make sure you join us there. In that same vein, October 9 to 11 is BAI Beacon, the financial services conference designed to take industry goals and challenges and break them down into actionable steps that are right for your organization. So JP and Jason, I know, will be there at as FinTech Forge and helping out there. And JP will be host and moderator of the Global Innovation Awards. So you can check that out at BAI.org. And October 22nd to 25th is Cybos. This is probably one of the longest running financial conferences. I was just reminiscing with Uday Goyal. You know Uday from Anthemis?
I don't know.
Well, he's not in Anthemis anymore. He's at APUS now. Mm-hmm. But Uday runs the future of money at InnerTribe there. But we met back in 2008 at InnerTribe with Swift. So it's been going on a decade now. And that was really where, all the early fintech guys sort of started. So 10 years, it's not like fintech is, like, sometimes we think of fintech as just a recent phenomenon, but a decade is, like, pretty decent.
Yeah, and I guess you have to give Swift props. You know, yeah. I think people are fond of saying Swift is old school, has old technology, but they were kind of ahead of a lot of people in having that, you know,
exactly.
That kind of feature.
Yeah, and, so, you know, this was sort of that first demo, you know, place, but the experiential stuff with the way they would always set up the event. Anyway, October 22nd to 25 is the Sibos conference. It's down in Sydney this year. I'll be there. Breaking Banks will be there. We'll be hosting a show from there. We'll be recording interviews. It's going to be lots of fun. If you have something you would like to share with our audience in terms of conferences or events that you think are should get on our roster, then email us at info@provoke.fm or hit us up on Twitter @BreakingBanks1. So what else is in the news this week, Penny?
Well, also on the crime front, we found it kind of interesting that the FBI issued a private notification to banks last Friday warning them that over the next several days they should expect some major cases of ATM cash outs.
Right.
So, but then interestingly enough, the very next day, Cosmos Bank in India was hit up with a huge ATM cash out event, I guess you call it, incident, where there were 14,849 ATM withdrawals in 28 countries within about 2 hours.
Wow.
So this was, you know, really well orchestrated. The bank lost $13.5 million. At the same time, the hackers also transferred 139 million rupees to a Hong Kong company account through three unauthorized transactions over the SWIFT network.
Wow.
So, you know, so then
does this exploit affect particular ATM brands? Like, is it a specific ATM type, or do we know if it's a Windows XP exploit? Or
I am not sure. I mean, generally speaking, the older machines are more vulnerable,
right, because
they're not as well patched, they're not as well maintained. In this case, it was a lot of different ATMs in many countries. I don't think it mattered because I believe this was all software-based,
right,
and there was a lot of clever maneuvering where even the requests for approval for these transactions were sent to proxy servers.
Wow.
So the banks never saw what was going on until it was too late.
So it's a pretty sophisticated attack.
Very sophisticated. And what I've heard in talking to people is that the mules who go and pick up the money don't even have to use, they don't have to have a card, they don't have to enter anything. It's all handled behind the scenes through software. So they only have to be there at a specific time. Exactly, completely automated.
That's crazy.
So, experts say there's still a lot to worry about. You could still expect to see more attacks like this. Criminals have been talking on the dark web about how they're doing this. So in
other news, we have Swift announcing a real-time cross-border payments network that they're testing in Asia Pacific. Goldman Sachs has announced they're going to bring their challenger, Marcus, to the UK. UK is sort of the proving ground right now for all these different challenger banks that are out there. OCBC has announced in Singapore they're launching a robo-investment service, a robo-advisor. Of course, Chase, JP Morgan Chase, announced their own mobile investment strategy here, didn't they?
I think they're working on something. They're going to offer free trades, seems to be the trend, free trading. And at the same time, they laid off 100 people in their asset management business.
Mm.
So it seems like I'm going to do
some
research.
The robots are coming.
Yeah. That's exactly.
That's the title, right? That's the article. And also in the similar vein, the Thai Central Bank has kicked off a digital currency project down there. So maybe it's a right time for me to move to Bangkok.
I
had a really good time there. Actually, Katie and I put a deposit on an apartment. I didn't tell you that.
But we'll
get into that offline. So let's now introduce our guest to the show this week. So Michael Turpin Michael, I'll let you introduce yourself and then we'll get into the specifics of the case. So first of all, what can you tell our listeners about yourself, Michael?
Sure. Nice to be on. Hi, Penny. I read you an American Banker, and I was just reading the ATM attack piece. So I think that you can see how many different sectors are now being hit by cyber thieves and cyber terrorists. And so obviously that's what this story is all about. Brett, I've known for many years. So my name is Michael Turpin, and I've been a long time marketer in the technology world. I had a PR firm in the 1990s that launched Earthlink and the Motley Fool, and then I started what's the third largest newswire for press releases in the world, MarketWire. I got sold at NASDAQ, since 2013, I've pretty much been concentrating on Bitcoin and the blockchain. I really saw it as an opportunity the size of the web. I have the same kind of feeling when I saw my first Mosaic browser in 93 is when I, learned about Bitcoin and the blockchain in 2013. I also, on the investment side, besides having my PR and advisory firm Transform Group, I also run a couple of conferences. Coin Agenda is the largest, oldest investor conference for blockchain investors in the world. And then Token Match, which is sort of a more boutique event for connecting investors. And I started BitAngels, the first angel network, in early 2013. So I've been sort of visible in the space. My PR firm, Transform Group, has done 103 ICOs, including Ethereum and the first one. So I'm fairly high visibility, and I've been in the community and speaking all over the world on the opportunities for blockchain. And I really see this following the same kind of rise as the internet, which 25 years ago was less than 20 million people, which is about how many people are involved in the blockchain. And of course, today it's over 4 billion, primarily because so many people can get the internet on their mobile phones. And I think that'll happen eventually with blockchain, and the mobile phones will be a very big part of bringing it to the 2/3 of the world that, in many cases has the mobile phone as their bank. And the blockchain makes it much more streamlined. But we have to solve the security problem first, and that's what my lawsuit is about, is the violation of basic security AT&T.
Before we get right into that, I also understand that you're part of a growing group of people who's also thinks that blockchain can solve problems like the problems faced in Puerto Rico, right?
Well, I was the first person from the blockchain community to move to Puerto Rico 3 years ago because they have great tax benefits, both personally as an investor and business-wise for services firms. A number of, there's now about 300 people in Puerto Rico. And we certainly see some Puerto Rico as a place with such a high concentration of sort of like leaders in the blockchain space down there, to see it as a little bit of a test bed to, innovate in certain areas. But that's really more private blockchain or sort of doing government on the blockchain. And that's not really my focus. There's other groups down there that are kind of leading the effort to, do solar blockchains and things like that. But I'm there basically because I love the place, my wife loves the place, and obviously moved there for the same reason I moved to Nevada a decade earlier, to have a lower tax base.
Fair enough. And these tech hubs or hubs that are setting themselves up for not just for low taxation, but specializing in licensing for non-traditional financial services operators and so forth. Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico actually has been very innovative in terms of being able to. They have, I'm there under Act 20 and Act 22, which is the Investor Act, which is the only place in the world that American citizens can pay zero tax to the U.S. and to the territory on all their capital gains worldwide, short and long term. You can go to China, you still have to pay the U.S. And then Act 22, which is basically, or rather Act 20, which is for services companies. And so that's 4% tax on your gross income if the service is performed in Puerto Rico and exported out of Puerto Rico. And that actually accounts for a lot of cloud services efforts as well. In fact, Microsoft is the largest user of that. Everything that they have is cloud software in Puerto Rico that goes to the rest of North and South America. They don't pay the IRS.
Is that partly why Puerto Rico is struggling financially? It's not getting
no. If anything, that's actually a complete misnomer, because it's not taking any money away from Puerto Rico. These people would not be in Puerto Rico if it wasn't for the tax incentive. And you know, they make you buy homes, they make you go and employ people. So there is the reason why they have an issue is that they've had programs like this for tax breaks, because when Puerto Rico was, you know, became a territory of the United States after it was invaded and taken over after the Spanish-American War, we also took over Dominican Republic and Philippines, but we let them go. We kept Puerto Rico, and you know, it had 50% unemployment. I mean, it's a place that, you know, naturally has, you know, very high unemployment, because, you know, it can't print its own money to compete against the rest of the Caribbean for tourism and to be able to, you know, price stabilize coffee. And those are really kind of the natural crops, tourism and coffee. And so there have been programs since the 60s to go and increase employment by bringing industries down with tax breaks. This happened across the U.S. as well. First, it was aerospace. It was called the Puerto Rico Miracle. It took Puerto Rico from one of the poorest nations of the Caribbean to the richest. And then it was medical, where there's still a very robust pharmaceutical industry. It happened from those tax breaks. Now, the problem was, these are all 20-year programs. When the 20-year pharmaceutical one expired, and by the way, most of the Mercks and Pfizer and those people stayed, and there's the seventh largest employer right now in the world, or producer of pharmaceuticals, if it was a standalone nation. The administration that then had a chance to go and do a new program kind of talked to the banks, we're talking about banking here, and said, hey, loans are so low, why do you need a program? Just take out a lot of debt at low interest. And so they took on $90 billion of debt, and it didn't really create enough jobs to go and pay it back. Whereas here, there's no debt taken on. Everybody who comes down here gets tax breaks, but they create jobs, they buy homes, they eat in fancy restaurants. There's no revenues taken away.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right. Well, listen, let's get into the main story of the day while you are here. So you mentioned, of course, yep, that you set up one of the largest angel groups for Bitcoin investors called BitAngels in 2013. And you set up a digital currency fund around that, BitAngels DApps Fund. And in respect to that fund, as I understand it, you had a loss of roughly about $24 million in cryptocurrency. But let's get
specific. It was not specific. From the fund. This is my personal fund, yeah.
Okay, from your personal fund. So let's talk specifically, though, about how these hackers that compromised your wallet and stole the cryptocurrency, how were they able to get access to your wallet or your crypto funds?
So I have screenshots that show that. So I've been hacked twice. The first time that I got hacked was in June of last year, and this is all in the lawsuit 69-page filing. If you just look up much of the coverage or the original press release that went on Globe Newswire, it's got a link to the entire lawsuit, so you can read the entire details. But basically, when I got hacked the first time for about half a Bitcoin, I mean, I've got very good security. I've got all my Bitcoin, my Ethereum, anything that you can put on a Trezor or a Ledger, it's on hardware, and those are on bank vaults. And, you know, as my wife says, somebody comes to my place with a gun and says, hand over your Bitcoins. It's like, do you want to accompany me to the bank, or should we call the police to go and accompany me too? I mean, they're not going to get into the bank vault.
Right.
So that's where the majority of you know, the crypto that I own is, in bank vaults. So people say crypto doesn't like banks. We certainly like bank vaults, safety deposit boxes. But there are certain tokens, and then I do have some things on exchanges when I'm, you know, buying and selling or receiving things for the short term. And all of those exchanges, there was some fake news, people just guessing. There was one report said, oh, I lost $20 million in Bitcoin on Coinbase. I don't have a Coinbase account, and none of this is Bitcoin. So all the exchanges that I have always been 2FA Google Authenticator. Authenticator is great because you have to actually have the physical device.
And so, key to that is that you would get a message through your phone to provide the second factor authentication to a login to a wallet, and your SIM card, which was on AT&T, was actually compromised in that someone was able to provision a new SIM card and effectively steal your phone number so they could trap those messages. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's often been called SIM swap, but that sounds like we're having like a little party game where we're swapping SIMs. It's SIM jacking.
So someone walked into an AT&T store pretending to be you, and they were given your phone number on a new SIM card, and then able to access your account because they had the two-factor challenge.
They could access my entire digital life because of that. This happened twice. The first time it happened to both AT&T and T-Mobile at the same time, the same day in Boston, and AT&T records show that they got turned down 11 times before somebody finally gave it up. You would think that AT&T internal policy would look at the record and say, oh, you know what? You've been in 10 other stores and 11 stores and been turned down. Why should I give it to you? So that was the first one. But because the first one was only a half a Bitcoin, and that was on a really old wallet that did not have any kind of Google 2FA protection, that's not really what the case focused on. It focuses on the second one. After AT&T gave me what's called the celebrity protection. It's called, and this is like if Brad Pitt needs to go in and make sure no one's hacking his photos of his, baby moon or something like that. They give you what is an unchangeable number. So it is not something to be reset by a SIM. It's something where they provide it to you. They gave it to me right in the store. They gave us, and so did T-Mobile, a 6-digit to 8-digit code that you have to write down, keep in a safe place because it cannot be changed. If you lose it, I was told you have to go through all sorts of work to go and get a new one because it can't be changed. And that's so that you can prevent a hack or an unauthorized use.
Even after that,
what the gist of our suit is. I have screenshots, which AT&T actually provided on their own in a store, and I have photos of the screenshots at the time, the first one showing the 11 things the first time, but the second one showing that the store in Connecticut had a rep, and at the top of the screen he was looking at, it said, high profile, high security, must ask for 6-digit code, and never did. There was everything that he did is in there. Never once did he ask for it.
That is our supposition.
It's one of two things. It's either just gross negligence in not following the rules, or what seems to be coming out from arrests that have happened in other similar cases involving AT&T in July, where these gangs now have figured out, hey, instead of going and waiting until we find somebody stupid, why don't we just bribe someone? And, reports are coming out that it can be as low as $80 and someone will just hand it over for you and say, yeah, I'll do that for some extra money, and as high as $1,000. It's pretty cheap to be able to get $20 million out of someone. The second aspect is that they mandatorily also have to take your ID to make sure it's real. And so they swipe it. They have the technology to be able to see if it's a real driver's license. It wasn't. It failed. Mm-hmm. The AT&T records say manual override, said swipe didn't work, manual override. So that's the main reason why we're led to believe that it was somebody who was actually involved in the effort. Why would you go in? One could say, oh, gee, I forgot to check the 6-digit thing. But why would you manually override a failure of an ID to swipe? And so, to me, the biggest thing, if crypto is to succeed and to become mainstream and to be on everybody's cell phones around the world, it's very simple to be able to go in and make it mandatory in the software. We know how bank software works. Imagine going into Wells Fargo, giving them a check and saying, I'd like to take $300 out. What do they say? Can you please put your PIN in? Can you imagine saying, I forgot my PIN, and then my ID doesn't work, give me the $300 anyway? That's the equivalent.
Well, you know, it also speaks to the fact that the way we verify identity today is no longer secure, right? Essentially, you know, we need better ways of figuring out that you are who you say you are. And just asking for a driver's license is no longer sufficient, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sort of proactive things that could be better, but the one immediate solution, and aside from this lawsuit, I want to be a spokesperson for this simple, quick, immediate solution, is just make it mandatory to ask everybody if they require a high security password. And if you give it to them once, make sure that it's mandatory, that if they don't have it, the system just shuts down and goes no further.
Use facial recognition or something, right? So, Penny, you had a question for Michael.
Not even necessary. Go on.
I read that at one point, these hackers were able to impersonate you via Skype and contact one of your clients and get the client to send cryptocurrency to them on your behalf. Do you think these people know you?
That was in the first hack, yes.
Do these people actually know you? Do they actually have somebody who looks and sounds like you? I mean, it's kind of a wild
case. No. It's real simple. If you get into, in that first hack, they were able to get into my Skype and change the password and lock me out because they got in with the phone number. After that one, I changed everything so there was no longer any phone number on anything. Or if there was a required phone number, it was a Google Voice, because you can't hack Google Voice. There's no Google Voice stores. You can't SIM swap. There's no SIM. So the only reason they got in this time was, after weeks of going in and changing everything, there was one piece of software that will come out in the trial that I had signed up for years ago that still had a phone number attached. And there's a lot of hacker reverse lookup tools. They can tell every single thing that is attached to that phone number, no matter how old it is. And so that's, again, why the simple solution is just simply block them if they're not you, provable by that six-digit unchangeable number. The odds of somebody guessing it are pretty low, right? So that alone, without facial recognition and everything else, will solve 99.9% of the problem. But going back to the Skype thing, they didn't have to impersonating me meant reading my – once you're inside my Skype, you can read my correspondence. And in this case, it said, where should I send the invoice? And they basically put their – or where should I send the payment to? And they basically put their – they said, send it here. And it basically – they read my mail – I mean, I think it was email, and said, where should I send the payment to? And they just put their Bitcoin address in, and they got paid.
So
I immediately, of course, as soon as I found out I lost it, I ended up blasting it on every social media that I had control of still. You know, my Facebook never got hacked. My Twitter never got hacked. You know, I've been hacked. Do not respond to anything that you're not certain is me. Ask for voice verification, which is always good in general if you're sending money to something that's online and you think it's someone and you're not 100% sure.
So in total, you had 24 million of cryptocurrency. What was that made up of? A suite of different currencies? Was it primarily Bitcoin?
Right. So that was not my entire amount of cryptocurrency. That was you have to remember that the date was essentially the high point of the altcoin market. So the Bitcoin price hit all time highs in December, and the altcoins hit an all time high right about that day that I got hacked. I don't know if that was the reason they picked that day, because they knew they could get the most money out, because it was like, you know, it was an $800 billion market cap for crypto that day. But basically, this was, I've worked with over 100 tokens on a marketing or advisory side. In many cases, they pay me with, you know, wire transfers, like any other PR firm. In many cases, they'll pay me with Bitcoin or Ethereum, in which case they're locked in a safe. And in many cases, they'll pay me with their own token. In this case, it was all what tokens that were smaller tokens that had inflated in value because of the run-up of altcoins, and that were not things that could be stored on hardware devices.
Okay. So listen, Michael, we've got just a couple of minutes before the break. In fact, about a minute and 30 seconds. So I don't want to sort of run out of time here. But in the next 30 seconds, what's the next steps? And, you know, what do you rate your chances of success on this?
Meaning both my legal team and I, think our success chances are excellent. We have a great case. I mean, we basically have the smoking gun of of a AT&T representative, not somebody pretending to be one, violating what they gave me as, you know, sort of my protection, my unimpeachable, unbreachable rather protection. And they proactively breached it. It's not like, you know, that they just simply, somebody else did it for them. They actively went and allowed this.
So I tell you what we'll do is we will have a follow-up on this once it gets to court. Obviously, these things take some time, but keep us in the loop. Let us know how it goes. Thanks for joining the show, Michael.
Thank you.
And Penny, thanks for joining us. We're just coming up to the break, but after the break, I've got an interview with PlayUp that have a new token issue coming out of Australia, the PlayChip token. So check it out because it's really, really interesting. So that's coming up after the break. For you guys, if you've got some stuff you want to tweet out, make sure you tweet to me, at Brett King, Penny Crossman, at Penny Crossman, one S.
That's right, S. one S in Crossman.
Or Emma Banker, A-M-E-R Banker.
That's right.
For American Banker, and of course, Breaking Banks One. So thanks for joining us. I'll be back right after this break with an interview from PlayUp on their new token issue out of Australia and a moment of snark from Ron.
Thank you.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about efinancialcareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. efinancialcareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, efinancialcareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
So this week, as we continue our discussion on everything that is blockchain and token related, I thought I'd get into a bit of detail around, you know, what is this difference that we keep hearing about in the market around, utility-based tokens versus security-based tokens and all of the issues that we hear from regulators like the SEC in the United States around what represents a good token. And I came across a really interesting group of guys out in Australia who are doing a global token issue right now. And to me, this sort of typifies the perfect example of a utility-based token. And I hope to get into that, and I hope you guys see why I think it's that case. But in any case, let me introduce you to the team down there. They're based in Sydney, but Luke, who's joining us today, is actually visiting Adelaide in south of Australia. Luke Loam from PlayUp, welcome to Breaking Banks.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Brett.
So let's first of all talk about how the ICO sector generally is maturing, from what you're seeing in Asia. And then I want to talk a little bit about the token that you guys have created. So, just before we started on the recording, you're talking about where you see the overall market in terms of the token market evolving. Maybe give me your thoughts on where we're at in that cycle right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, so I think the whole ICO landscape, the blockchain industry as a whole, has been through rapid development since it really came to the fore with Satoshi's white paper back in 2008, 2009. It started with Bitcoin, obviously, this peer-to-peer digital cash, a currency. And then we saw other currencies popping up, you know, fun ones like Dogecoin, real ones like Litecoin and Dash. And it was all about this peer-to-peer exchange of value. And that was where the sort of the value for blockchain really seemed to be. Then Vitalik came along a few years later and introduced Ethereum and the idea of smart contracts, these Turing-complete contracts that were able to be embedded within the code of the blockchain. And that opened up a whole world of possibility in terms of building these decentralized apps or dApps on top of Ethereum. And so what we've seen are these companies that are looking to solve a myriad problems in the full spectrum of industries. You know, I don't think there's an industry that's not going to be touched by blockchain, from real estate to healthcare to charities to licensing and royalties, you name it. I think there's a purpose for blockchain in some way or shape. But what we've seen is this explosion of dApps, and particularly in the last sort of 12 to 24 months as the market's really taken off. Almost too much activity. In fact, I wouldn't say almost, there is too much activity, and we're going to have to definitely see some consolidation. I think the last time I checked the stats was we were approaching 3,000 ICOs that have been published or announced this year, which is just phenomenal. And it shows the amount of interest in the space and the amount of potential in the space. What it also means is that most of these are being built on top of Ethereum, and Ethereum has massive scaling problems and massive speed problems. You know, as you know, it's only capable of handling around 14 transactions a second, which is obviously not ideal. And the more of these dApps built on top of Ethereum, the more problems that are going to emerge. Now, they've got some ways to solve these problems, but obviously what's been really interesting is to see these emergence of Ethereum competitors, these alternative protocols that are looking to solve the scaling and the speed problem. We've seen EOS raise something crazy like $4.2 billion in their ICO. We've seen Cardano, Quark Chain, P Chain, Zilliqa. You know, there are a host of these new protocols that are emerging that are promising higher throughput, higher speed, better scalability, lower cost, essentially. And so that's where all the money seems to be going at the moment. You know, in my travels through the States and through Asia and Europe, a lot of the institutional money, the VCs that I'm talking to, that's where they see the upside. That's where they see the big returns. And so the money's really drying up for the dApp space, and it's becoming a very difficult market for ICOs trying to raise money. As you're well aware, we're in a bear cycle. It's an extended bear cycle coming down from the lows of December last year. Bitcoin is hovering around $6,500 USD at the time of this conversation, and we don't really know where it's going to go from here. My feeling is it's probably going to bounce a little lower before it comes back up. But it's a really tough environment. People are reticent to throw money into these dApps, particularly when you have, you know, up to 20 or 30 or even more different companies trying to solve the same problem in the same vertical. So it becomes a matter of, well, which horse do you back? You don't know which ones are going to emerge and which ones aren't going to emerge. So that's sort of what's happening, I see, in the dApp space. But all the money is now shifting over to the protocols, like I mentioned, and now we're starting to see a bit of a saturation of the protocols. You know, there are 15 to 20 that I'm aware of that are looking to solve the scaling and speed problem and go head-to-head with Ethereum and EOS, you know. So it's going to be interesting to see what emerges there, because not all of them are going to work. You know, at the end of the day, you need to build one highway, not 20. So which one is going to be the highway that everyone gets on top of? So what's, I think, interesting about PlayChip is I think we're representative of the next phase of the development of ICOs, and that is the reverse ICO. The reverse ICO simply means that it's an existing business. It has real revenue, it has real users, it has a real product that's currently in the market. It's unlike current ICOs, where in most cases you have a white paper and you have a plan and a roadmap, and you're going to market with maybe an MVP, like a minimum viable product or some sort of proof of concept, and saying, listen, we've got this idea, we need your money so we can spend the next, you know, 12 months, 2 years, 3 years developing it. And then once we finish development, then we can take it to market and hopefully start making some money. That's obviously a bit of a crapshoot. But when you've got a company that has real traction, that has, you know, a growing user base and has a product that's already selling, then it changes the conversation significantly. And similar to what occurred in the...
Let's take a step back and let's talk about the business that you've got, PlayUp, and then, you know, where tokens fit into the business. So describe for our listeners what PlayUp does and, the growth that you're experiencing right now.
Yeah, no problem. Sorry, you need to shut me down sometimes. I tend to get carried away. So feel free to jump in, Brett. So PlayUp is parent company is the first partner of the PlayChip. Now, the PlayChip is essentially the universal gaming token for sports betting, general gaming, fantasy sports, esports, casino games and table games and so on. It's in an operating business. We already have over 900,000 users. In fact, I think, you know, pretty much any day now, we're likely to tick over the 1 million mark, which we're going to be announcing far and wide. We have seven platforms or seven apps that you can download in the App Store and Google Play right now. These are a range of daily fantasy sports, general sports betting. You can bet on pretty much any sport around the world, whether it be the NFL in the States, the Premier League, the football or the cricket in Australia, horse races and so on. So it really does cover the full gamut of sports, betting and gaming and daily fantasy sports and the massively booming space of esports as well, which I'm not sure if your listeners are too familiar with, but esports is essentially kids playing computer games and other kids watching it. It's quite fascinating to see how the evolution of this industry.
This is, for example, the platform Twitch in the it's global platform now, but started in the US.
Correct.
And others, these platforms for this, and you now have stadiums of kids coming together playing games like Fortnite and other things like that in big money competitions, right? They can, prizes can, be in the hundreds of thousands for a winner of a tournament, right?
Absolutely. And you're spot on. A friend of mine has a production company in Los Angeles. They recently produced an event in London, which was for just a little mobile game that you play on your iPhone or your Android called Clash of Clans. And they had 8,000 or 9,000 people in this stadium watching these two kids sitting on stage playing on their iPhones with giant screens behind them. And you see much bigger events than that even in Asia. Like you said, playing, CSGO, Counter-Strike, Fortnite, League of Legends, all these games. So we're tapping into that fervor of activity by applying an additional layer, allowing people to place bets on it. Obviously, we're not aiming at children. That's, completely unethical, and that's not what we're doing. But there is a whole bracket of the late teen to the early to mid-30s, the 18 to 35 category, which play games like your Counter-Strike. And we see there as being a massive opportunity for us to sort of leverage the platforms that we have.
Cool. So you have your fantasy football, your fantasy leagues, you have your esports and your sports betting. How has the recent US Supreme Court decision coming out of New Jersey, how does that affect the potential for the business?
It's been really, really interesting, Brett. That was announced when I was in New York. I was actually at a couple of blockchain events in New York and was thrilled when that came through. And it really has changed the dynamic of the conversation with institutional money in the States also. Essentially what happened for your listeners is that there is a PSPA, a professional and amateur sporting regulation that banned sports betting essentially in the United States. It was happening, but it was happening sort of in the off the books. But in New Jersey, which is a sort of very forward state when it comes to gaming, have been challenging this for some time, took it to the Supreme Court. It was overturned. And so now it's basically paved the way for sports betting to be legalized across the United States, which is a massive market and unlocks huge potential. So really exciting for us there. The other interesting things that are going on in terms of the regulatory environment are that the sports Ministry of India have also been signaling that they're looking to make some moves in the sports betting space as well. In terms of the timing, we're not quite sure how that'll play out, but very positive steps taken there. Brazil looking at doing the same thing. And really interestingly is China. Now, Hainan Island is down towards the south end of China, not too far from Macau and Hong Kong. And they're looking at making Hainan sort of a special zone as well. This has been on the cards for some time, but allowing horse racing, paramutual betting, and sports lotteries as well. So this is repositioning Hainan to be a competitor to Macau. Not looking at building physical casinos there, but starting with this whole sports betting infrastructure. So potentially we're looking at 3 billion people joining in the worldwide ecosystem. So the general macro environment for the market is very positive.
Very good. So now, in terms of the token itself, explain how, the token that you're issuing as part of the ICO for PlayUp, PlayChip, explain how that is used within the business on a day-to-day basis versus what we tend to see where we're focused on speculation of the token as a sort of a cryptocurrency. Explain how business utilizes the token every day.
Sure. So on a broad level, there are two major classifications for tokens. There's a security token and a utility token. Security token generally represents a claim to underlying equity within a company or within a platform. It's like a share, essentially. Then there's a utility token, which serves a functional purpose within an ecosystem. And that's what the PlayChip is. It's really a utility token. We are Regulation D exempt in terms of the states to make sure we're compliant there. But we are really a utility token, and it acts almost like a currency of sorts within our ecosystem. It's an expanding ecosystem. Like I mentioned before, we have 7 different apps. We have PlayUp, which is a fantasy sports platform, DraftStars, which is, again, a fantasy sports, Top Better, Classic Bet, Betting Club, 123bet was a new acquisition we just recently made. And the PlayChip is going to be the token that allows people to seamlessly move between these applications. So they can bet on any kind of environment. They can participate in these experiences in any kind of environment seamlessly and frictionlessly. It allows a multitude of benefits as opposed to just having cash or fiat. For example, there's better liquidity. There are faster payouts. You can instantly cash out rather than waiting for bank transfers to go through. The whole application of the blockchain provides a level of trust and security that we don't ordinarily see. And I think the gambling and gaming market is one that's ripe for this innovation. It's quite opaque. People don't know what they're playing with. They don't know how the odds are put together. They don't know if they're table games like casino games, poker and baccarat and blackjack. They don't know who they're playing against, whether it's a bot or computers or the system's even rigged. So the way this whole infrastructure is being established is to provide provably fair betting environments and gaming environments. Great social networks. It allows for transcending of borders, so you're not fixed to just the country you're operating in. You can bet games all around the world, participate all around the world. It's a great social network as well. There's a real host of benefits to having the token at the heart of this whole ecosystem.
And the token itself, does it appreciate in value as well?
I want to be careful with what I say here, Brett. I don't want to give any indication one way or the other of what the future value of the token would be. However, I can tell you the mechanism by which the value is determined, and it's simply supply and demand. So there is a finite number of tokens in supply. 50 billion tokens have been minted. There will never be any more made. That is it. And then with these tokens, when they're in circulation, it's about user adoption. And it's about the utility function that they serve. So the more that people are using them, the more demand that is placed on them. And if there's a finite supply, then that invariably leads to an increase in price over time. That said, it's in our interest to ensure that there is stability within that price. You know, some of the fluctuations and the volatility in the market aren't ideal. And most of this is due to speculation. And it comes back again, Brett, to the fact that many ICOs out there, they don't have working products right now. So even if they are a utility token, technically, they don't actually have a product where people can utilize the token in. And so they're still in the development phase and they're still building out their platforms. And it's a matter of time before eventually they'll have a product and then people can use the token for what the token was intended rather than just for speculation. So in that in-between phase of when the token is listed on an exchange and when it's actually able to be used within a platform, it's all really up to market forces and that speculation. So that's why you see this massive volatility. the beautiful thing about the play chip is that when we release, when we list on exchanges, utility will be instantly applicable. So you will be able to use the play chip in this ecosystem straight away. So it takes a lot of that speculative volatility out of the whole play. And with our existing user base of around 1 million users now, which was growing rapidly, then we'll see instant demand for the token, which is obviously going to drive the whole ecosystem forward.
And of course, people can, they don't have to necessarily buy the token, because if they're participating in the fantasy football leagues or the fantasy cricket leagues, for example, they can actually win the tokens by playing those platforms, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's been one of the, sort of the big winners in terms of our user acquisition processes. We're big in some of the developing markets like India, for example, with playup.com, which is our sort of our first partner in the ecosystem. This is a free-to-play daily fantasy sports game where you sign up, you just provide your email address, and you get given 100 play chips out of the gates. And so then with that, if you assemble your teams and you're successful and you enter different competitions, and many of these competitions are free to enter as well, you can acquire and amass these play chips. And once these play chips, once we're listed and it turns into the crypto around December, then you have instant play chips, which is a great little bonus that not many other people are offering, I don't think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if you want to get some free tokens, there's a way to do it. So even if it's only 100 tokens, great. All right, well, that's great, Luke. So just to wrap up before we go to break, can you let me know what are your plans for the rest of the year? You're right in the midst of the token raise. When do you think you'll close that out? And where do you think you guys will be at by the end of the year?
Yeah, sure. Just before I address a couple of those questions, if I may just make one more point, which I think is really interesting for your listeners, is that we're actually creating our own wallet and exchange that's all in one in this one app. So essentially, you'll have in your pocket, and our 1 million users will have instant access to a crypto wallet and a crypto exchange. You can load up this wallet you can link it to your Bitcoin, Ethereum, or Litecoin, or other altcoin accounts and hot wallets. And then you can also link it to your credit card or bank. And then you can purchase play chips, use them within the ecosystem, get winnings, take your winnings, and then cash them out straight back into your credit card, straight back into your bank, which is quite interesting. But it also allows you to transfer between play chips and other cryptocurrencies as well. So you have it all in one in your pocket, which creates a really seamless user experience. And what it basically means is that once we activate this in December, we're going to have over 1 million users that will have access to this and creating an instantly sort of global top 20 crypto exchange by user number, which is really kind of unique and something special that I think is worthy of mention. But coming back to the logistics of the ICO, we are in pre-sale right now. We started on June the 1st. We're rolling through until October 31st. There's currently a 20% bonus applicable if you're to sign up and join us. And this reduces each month. So the sooner you get in, obviously, the more bonus you get. The public ICO is from November the 21st until the 28th. And then we are listing on exchanges on December the 19th. And that's when the whole platform goes live with the first version of the whole the AlphaNet. So we're busy working on that end from a technical point of view, from the marketing side of things. Obviously, we did a roadshow through the US and Europe, which was fantastic. Did a quick trip up to Shanghai just to test the waters there. And we'll be heading back to China in September to do our own private roadshow in Beijing and Shanghai. I've also been invited to speak at an event in Indonesia, which looks interesting. So obviously it's busy getting the word out there, letting people know what we're all about, letting people understand how we're a little unique in the space with this reverse ICO setup. And also just something to mention as well, we've raised around over $20 million so far in just the first month or two of action. So I'm sorry.
Or conventional financing or through the token raise?
Through both. There was a seed round where there was really very little to no marketing at all, and that was raised for investors close to the company. We raised around $8 million there, and then since then we've raised through a combination of retail investors and VC money, mainly VC money and institutional at this stage.
Great. Well, it sounds like you guys are off to a flying start, and good for us to see a real utility-based token at work here rather than something that's sort of purely speculative. So where can people find out more about the token raise?
Sure, check out our website, which is playchip.global. It's the best place to start. You'll find all the information you need there. There's a detailed token offering document, pitch deck, and various pieces of information.
Or, of course, they go to playup.com as well, right?
Absolutely. Playup.com, which is our fantasy sports platform, and that'll link you straight through to PlayChip also.
Fantastic. Well, Luke Lom, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today and telling us more about your ICO and sort of where the blockchain market's at generally.
Thanks very much, Brett. Appreciate the time.
Well, that's another Breaking Banks for this week. Thanks for joining us. Before we close out the show, though, we have the inimitable Ron Shevlin returning this week with a moment of snark. See you next week on Breaking Banks.
If I had a nickel for every banker that told me that his or her institution pursues a fast follower strategy when it comes to technology, I'd be on the Forbes richest people list. Speaking of Forbes, a recent study reported in the magazine found that first movers had a 47% failure rate, and companies that took control of a product's market share after the first movers pioneered them had only an 8% failure rate. Now, what kind of nonsense is that? The 53% of the first movers who did succeed may have earned fantastically high rates of return on their investments and captured market share that was never lost to the later movers. What did the later movers get? They might not have failed, but did they generate the same returns as the first entrants? Did they capture profitable segments of the market? Then there's the Business Insider article titled, "You're Better Off Being a Fast Follower Than an Originator," which relates the story of GoTo.com, which launched a pay-per-click search engine in 1998, 2 years before Google did. And you know how that story played out. The false premise here is that the so-called fast followers making a choice to not launch before others do in order to wait for them to make mistakes or in order to learn more about customer problems. Was Google's search engine ready to go back in 1998? Did they consciously sit back and say, hey, let's let the bozos from GoTo.com launch first and fail so we can swoop in and learn from their mistakes? I don't know. Maybe they did, but I doubt it. Many proponents of a fast follower strategy justify it with stories like the one in Forbes and Business Insider. But the whole concept of a fast follower strategy is stupid. Why? Because a successful business strategy involves understanding the needs of a particular segment or segments of a market and serving those segments better than the competition does. Now, if a better serving a segment means being first to market with a new technology, then being a fast follower is a stupid strategy. And if effectively serving your chosen market segments doesn't require the deployment of the latest technology, say because those segments aren't early adopters, then being a first mover or a fast follower is a stupid strategy. Even if there was a reason to be a fast follower, the reality is that most banks and credit unions couldn't execute on it. To do it, they would need three things in place. Number one, a team of people evaluating technology developments in the market and accurately assessing their rates of adoption and potential economic impact. Number two, a team of people to rapidly deploy the technology innovations after a go decision was made. And number three, an agile, rapid planning process that took in the inputs from the team in point number one and made the quick decision to fund the team from point number two. Now, how many banks claiming to be fast followers have those things in place? Right, none. I'm Ron Shevlin, Director of Research at Cornerstone Advisors, and this is the Moment of Snark on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time for more of the latest in fintech news.